Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Rebecca Frayray. I'm a Deputy State Public Defender, number 20010, appearing on behalf of Mr. Radloff. I think there's only one issue, and I want to get started right away with the standard of review, which is a abuse of discretion standard. And I understand that this court has to give deference to the trial court's order in this case where it's supported by the record, and I hope the court realizes what my position is that the court's order isn't supported by the record in every instance. I think in some instances it is, but the court, the reason that the order is not supported by the record is because the trial judge did not go back and review the trial transcripts and evaluate the trial evidence as part of his order. And we know he didn't do that because he said he didn't intend to review the transcripts, and that's on disc 3, page 114. At the end of the hearing, he said, I don't intend to go reread the trial transcripts. And there was a four-year lapse of time between the time the trial occurred and the time that the hearing ended. And I just think it's humanly impossible to remember all of the details of a trial 4 years after it has occurred. So I think the order reflects what the judges stated he intended to do. I think the controlling case here is the Farrar case, and I'm not going to talk about the first three factors of the four-part test because the judge found Mr. Radloff proved those. What he concluded, however, was that the new evidence did not make it probable that there would be an acquittal on a retrial. I think Farrar kind of expands that. The new evidence must be meaningfully contradictory such that a reasonable juror would probably acquit the defendant with the new trial evidence. But that fourth part of the test requires the judge to evaluate all of the circumstances, what was testified to at trial, and also, as the AG noted in her brief, what the new trial what a judge would hear at a new trial, what a jury would hear at the new trial. I think the primary omission from the judge's order is his failure to consider the reason for the recantation in this case, and that is the domestic abuse. The victim indicated in the affidavit that she and her family had been subjected to domestic violence for years, and that she knew that if she reported it, her mother would deny it, that if she got my client out of the home, it would be for a short period of time and he would be back. And the judge didn't consider any of that. That's a huge part of the affidavit in the context of the trial, and there is significant evidence at trial of this domestic abuse situation. There is significant evidence at trial that was presented that she was making false allegations, and those are not part of the order.
Is it clear from the judge's order that he didn't consider those things or that he rejected them based on his recollection of what happened at the trial?
I think that he didn't remember them, and so he didn't consider them. I think what he did is he evaluated the victim's credibility, and clearly, I'm not debating that she was more defensive at the new trial hearing, but she was facing perjury charges. She had been advised by this lawyer that she signed the affidavit before that she was looking at civil liability, potentially criminal liability. And so, she was defensive at the hearing, and he did compare her credibility from the trial to the hearing. He mentioned the evidence of flight. That was evidence from the trial that did, he said there was some other evidence that supported there being the jury's verdict here and the conviction. But that, he didn't assess what EC's testimony was at trial. He didn't mention this whole Wyoming incident that was brought out during her sister's cross-examination at trial that the defense fought hard to keep out because it was evidence of Mr. Radloff's abusiveness that really wasn't relevant in the context of the sexual assault, but it becomes highly relevant in the context of the recantation.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Excuse me. If you can imagine yourself in a trial judge's position and the witness says, I'm going to take the Fifth Amendment, therefore I will not affirm the statements I have in my affidavit, what are you supposed to do with that information?
Well,
you're not even sure if the affidavit is true because nobody will attest to it.
Right. Well, and I think that's why you have to go back and look at the trial record to see, is there any basis for this, or is she just pulling this out of thin air? First of all, she did take the Fifth, so she didn't affirm that anything in the affidavit was true, but she did testify at the hearing and admitted that she reviewed the contents of the affidavit with the lawyer. She signed the affidavit. She did not disavow it. She could very easily have disavowed the affidavit and not been facing any liability and not be in the position that she was in, but she didn't do that. She didn't say, this guy made this stuff up. And she could have said that at the hearing. If this court were, as an alternative to granting a new trial, remand the case for the judge to consider the whole trial record, there could be a full hearing from her. She no longer faces any criminal liability as a result of that. She could testify at trial about all of the circumstances of the affidavit. But I think we have Joseph Scheidler's testimony. He was not the specific lawyer in the direct appeal, but he testified to their conversations. The trial judge accepted his testimony as true, and there was support for the evidence of domestic violence. And I think that is an independent corroboration of the information in the affidavit. I mean, the judge didn't consider the testimony from a friend of hers, a classmate, A.B., who came in at the trial and said she hated her father, she would do anything she could to get him into trouble, and she said she would accuse him falsely of sexual abuse. The judge didn't consider that in terms of the information provided in the affidavit. The judge didn't consider the same statements she made to her sister. She encouraged her sister to make up these false allegations of abuse. That's information that at a new trial that a jury would look at and say, wow, okay, she told her sister she hated Mr. Radloff.
Oh, well, the jury heard that though, Ms. Frey.
They heard, yes, they heard all of that. But if they had also heard why she was making these, why was she encouraging her sister to falsely accuse him? Why was she telling this classmate, who had no reason to lie about that at trial, that she was going to? There was a motion that defense counsel filed, that's in volume one at page 133, where he sought to introduce additional evidence from people that the victim had made statements to, saying she was going to accuse him for all the sex she'd had with the boys, and the court denied that. But that might be evidence relevant at the new trial.
Excuse me for interrupting, but I'm trying to understand what at the core is your argument that the error here, the fundamental error here, was that the judge didn't review the trial transcript. Is that the argument?
Well, that is the problem. What I think that the trial judge didn't do was to assess the contents of the affidavit, the reason for the recantation, in light of all of the evidence that was introduced at trial about it.
Well, but that's different, because what we have is the same trial was the same judge who heard the trial.
Right.
And so he makes a credibility determination that the victim was more credible at trial than she is in her affidavit and on the motion for new trial,
right,
because of new evidence. Now, what I guess I hear you saying is he shouldn't have made that determination without going back and reviewing everything rather than relying on his memory.
Right.
And I'm troubled by the kind of line we have to draw in terms of telling trial judges, every time you get a case like this, you got to go back and look at the trial transcript.
Well, I think that what he did is he relied on her demeanor, and I think you're right. He didn't go back and probably review the transcript.
But is he entitled to rely on her demeanor at the hearing? I mean, this is a credibility call, isn't it?
I think he is, but you have to look at her demeanor and what was the cause of it. It was because she faced perjury charges, possibly, not because the information in the affidavit was
inaccurate. That goes into the analysis, no question about it. Yeah. But he's not bound. He's not bound to accept that she is more credible now than she was. He can make the choice, can he not? I mean,
he can.
That's what the trial judge does all the time.
Exactly. I agree with that. But I don't think that he made that decision based on a full review of what her credibility was at trial, because he just simply didn't remember. I mean, if you look at But she talked about at sentencing in her letter to my client at the sentencing, the three things that she will remember most about my client: him putting her brother in a closet for using the word punk, the Wyoming incident, which I think is probably what triggered the allegations in this case, and then the sexual abuse. And if you look at the, I don't know how the judge could not consider the Wyoming evidence, because it happens.
How do you know that he didn't?
Because he doesn't mention it.
Okay.
He doesn't mention it in the order.
In a credibility determination, Ms. Frary, a trial judge doesn't sit down and list every single item that he or she thinks bears on the credibility of the witness. He can simply say, I don't find you credible, ma'am, based upon your body language or based upon some other thing. And how are we to go behind that? How can we go behind that?
Well, because he said he wasn't going to review the transcript, so I think you can take him at his word. So I think what he did is he assessed her credibility, simply her demeanor, which is the only thing he mentions in the order, in his order. And I think that the Farrar case requires a more in-depth analysis when somebody's freedom is on the line, when someone may be imprisoned potentially for something that they didn't do. That's why the standard is what it is. You have to assess that new evidence in light of the entire trial record and all the circumstances. How can you determine whether this is meaningfully contradictory evidence under Farrar unless you go back and you read everything that was introduced and you have a good context for assessing that? I don't see how you can do that unless you have a superhuman memory. But it's just, it's not possible without going back and reading the record. And I think, yes, in these situations, that's what a trial judge has to do. Even if he was the sitting judge at trial, there's been 4 years. There are things in his order that are incorrect. He says she's 18 when she makes this affidavit. She isn't. She is 17 when she testifies at trial. She is 19 when she signs the affidavit. She's 20 when she appears at the hearing.
Let me interrupt again, because I'll go back to the question that I had before. I'm struggling with how we would draw this line. What if the trial was 2 or 3 months before this motion was filed?
I think that would be different. I think it would be fresher. I think it would be much
harder. How do we know that? Because we don't know anything about the memory of this trial judge versus that trial judge.
I don't know that this court has to draw a line, because I think the case law draws the line. I think the Farrar case says you have to review the new evidence in light of the entire trial record. That means you have to look at it if you don't remember it. And I think that's inescapable. I think you have to look at everything, and he just doesn't mention it in his order, and much of his order is refuted by the record that she was trying to establish a relationship with her mother. Well, there was uncontested evidence that they were in an established relationship for 2.5 years when this hearing happened. This young lady, she turned 18. She walked from foster care. She, within a few months, moved from Pueblo to Colorado Springs, was living with the same boyfriend she was living with at the hearing. She got a full-time job as a dancer at a strip club. She was on her own. She wasn't relying on her mother. Her mother didn't provide her financial support. That's uncontested at the hearing. So that part of the judge's order is refuted by the record. The judge's order about elaborating on her story, well, elaborating isn't synonymous with making up information. In fact, the detective testified. Every time she said something to the social worker about the case, I got a call from the social worker. I brought her into the police station. We talked 5 to 6 times between the time charges were filed and the time of trial. That's unusual. In most sex assault on child cases, the forensic interviews the kid, and the kid doesn't talk again until the trial. So I think, I don't know that that necessarily is a reflection of her credibility, but I think this order, it omits some significant evidence that was presented at trial that corroborates and makes more believable the allegations in the affidavit. So based on that, I'm going to save my remaining time. I would ask you to grant Mr. Radloff a new trial, or in the alternative, remand for findings in light of Farrar and a review of the entire trial record. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Kathy Gillespie, and I'm representing the people of the state of Colorado today. Excuse me, I've got a cold. My registration number is 26109. I first just want to state that my notes of my record review show that on disc 3, which was April 4th, 2008, on page 102, the trial court at the end of the hearing indicates that he is going to need to review the transcripts and do a written order in a future date. So I don't think that the record is clear just on the face of it as to whether or not he reviewed those trial transcripts. And I think the court brings up a good distinction here. This judge didn't have any qualms about his memory of the trial. He made a detailed finding listing the facts that he looked at in finding that this new evidence was not warranting a new trial. In my brief, I listed all of the indicators, and what Ms. Freire is leaving out is all of the information that he had presented at the new trial hearing, which was that this affidavit that was prepared by the defense attorney was prepared from notes he took during the phone call with the victim's mother. So the victim's mother calls the defense attorney and says she wants to come in and recant. She then, according to the attorney's testimony, gives him the details of the recantation, so that when the victim comes into the office 3 hours later, driven by her mother, who is still in a relationship with the defendant and supporting him, the victim comes in, reviews the affidavit, and signs it. We have no indication from the victim at any point that she is agreeing with this affidavit, of her signing it with her mother present. We have her recanting a month after the mandate issued from the Supreme Court in his direct appeal, and after the conversation which came out at the hearing that the mother had talked to the defendant's mother and had been told by the defense attorney that now that the mandate's issued, barring new evidence, he's staying in jail, he's not getting out. And within a month, the victim's recanting her story. So I think there were a lot of credibility issues that were presented at trial. I mean, this was not a case of your six-year-old child in pigtails with a clean credibility history and a clean accusation coming in and testifying, and all of a sudden now, 4 or 5 years later, she's recanting the story. The jury heard all of this. The jury heard the mother and the victim's sister just thrash her during trial about her sexuality, her lying. They heard from her boyfriend at trial that he considered her to be a pathological liar. They got all of that information at trial and still chose to believe beyond a reasonable doubt that he was guilty of some of the sex assaults. So I think the Farrar standard is not a reasonable juror. It's whether a reasonable person with the appropriate degree of skepticism and awareness of the circumstances, not a typical juror, would believe this new version of events. And I think this particular judge, who had sat through the trial, called it correctly. And I think, again, as this court has alluded to, this isn't a question of whether or not this court would do something different based on the same circumstances. The question is, taking the trial court's ruling, is there support for it in the record? And there absolutely is. This trial judge talks about the fact that this victim was, you know, her credibility was challenged at trial. He, and I agree with the court, doesn't have to go through everything that he considers. Just because it's not a fact that he mentions doesn't mean that he didn't consider it. But even looking at what he talks about, her defensiveness, her being uncomfortable, her demeanor at trial, even under aggressive cross-examination, so he clearly remembers the tone of cross-examination with his victim at trial, was much better than what we saw at the hearing here. Detective Anderson, he found him to be more credible on the issue of whether or not she was influenced by a prior interview with her little brother. He talks about the fact that the mother had not supported the victim throughout the pendency of the trial, and during that time the victim was cooperating with the detective, was consistent in her allegations, and it is only after she has reestablished contact with her mother, has found out that the mandate's issued and the only way the defendant's getting out of jail is a new trial, that this recantation comes forward. And Ms. Freire says that the evidence was uncontested that the mother wasn't supporting the victim during the period of this 35C hearing. That's not accurate. In the 35C hearing, the prosecutor asked the victim if her mother was giving her money. during this period of time, and she took the Fifth. When she asked if her mother had given her a car, she took the Fifth. So we don't have information on that. And again, I think it brings up, the trial court has to look at this and say, if this evidence is presented at trial, what is the chance that it would change the outcome of the trial? We don't even know if this would come in at trial because the victim didn't even agree with the affidavit as far as in front of the trial court, but did state that it was written by the defense attorney, not her attorney, not the mother's attorney, but the defendant's attorney, and that it was written by information given by her mother, who drove her to the appointment and then sat in the room while she signed the affidavit. So I think this is a textbook case as to why these decisions need to be left with the trial court and why they need to be looked at with such unbelievable suspicion when you are talking about a child sex assault case. Because from this record that the trial court was looking at, it is a textbook case of this young child or young woman trying to put a family back together after seeing the destruction that this conviction may or may not have caused within this family. And I think the timing was suspicious. I think the trial court saw that. And based on the standard that the Supreme Court here has set out for us, the record clearly supports the trial court's decision. And my recollection is the evidence in the record was the trial court did review the transcripts. And I think when you go through the factors that the trial court lists in its decision, it's clear that he did have a very good either recollection of the trial itself or had reviewed the transcripts.
What do you do with some of these assertions that the trial court's statements in the order aren't supported by the record?
I disagree that they aren't supported by the record. I think when you read the hearing and the testimony that was presented, her age was incorrect, but I think that can also be just a typographical error on the court's part. And the difference between 18 and 19 really isn't relevant to what we were looking at here. But I think there is evidence in that hearing that supports each and every factual support he gave in his order, that once the mother came into her life, she was trying to establish a relationship with her mother. There's nothing to say that just because she had been in contact with her for longer than a month means that they had this relationship already established. I mean, it was clear, and the crucial questions that the court really needed answers to in order to support the victim's theory or the defendant's theory, the victim took the Fifth on. So we don't have any evidence on that. You know, a lot of this is just supposition as to what she would even testify to if it went back to a trial.
But we do have, I mean, the affidavit was admitted at the hearing as part of the evidence, was it not?
It was.
So even though she didn't affirm the affidavit at the hearing, we have to consider the affidavit, do we not?
You do, but I think if you consider the affidavit, you also have to consider the incredibly suspicious circumstances under which it was written. And the fact that you have a woman, a mother, who has never supported her daughter throughout this trial, who in fact testified and wrote affidavits against her in support of the defendant, who at the hearing said she was still in whatever relationship they could maintain while he was in prison, driving this young woman to the defendant's attorney's office with the recantation already worked out before she gets there. I think you have to consider that. The trial court clearly did, and knowing the circumstances of this case, didn't find it believable at all. So I think that there is support in the record for each of the facts he relies on. And I think that this court has to acknowledge that it's an abuse of discretion and that it's the record supports his findings. So I would ask the court to affirm the trial court's decision. Thank you.
Just briefly, I would ask you to look closely at Joseph Scheidler's testimony, because I believe his testimony was that he was contacted by Mrs. Radloff regarding the affidavit, not by the victim's mother. The victim's mother transported her to the interview because the victim never had a car. Victim never said that there was a car purchased. She maintained throughout the hearing that she didn't have a car. So there's no evidence in the record to show that mom may have given her a car. She took the Fifth when asked if mom ever provided her any money, but she clearly said her mother never paid for housing, never provided any support as part of it. I think as far as timing goes, the affidavit explains she felt guilty. Yes, the appeal was over, and there was nothing else that could be done. I see I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted. We'll issue a written opinion in due course.